I edited the Sherlock Holmes Journal from 1976 to 2006, and am an honorary member of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London. I started collecting Sherlock Holmes stuff when I was, 14, and have a reasonable good collection. In 2017, I was approached by the owners of a bus for hire company, a London bus for hire company, which would go to weddings and funerals and bar mitzvahs, etc., with a view to writing a script for them, because they wanted to do a tourist bus tour of London, going past all sorts of Sherlock Holmes locations. And I wrote this script, and it was recorded by a very good radio actor called Steve Critchlow. And the bus was prepared, and various permissions then tried to be got from local authorities and various authorities in London. And sadly and unfortunately, the tour never did go ahead. And indeed, the bus company itself has since ceased trading. However, there was one expedition when the commentary was used in its proper way, when members of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London took the tour as part of a festival, a Sherlock Holmes festival they were holding in London in 2017. And so this is the basis of the script that was used then, and it's only been used that once and maybe never again. So this is perhaps a nice opportunity for it to have another life. I was asked to write it in the form of it being delivered by Dr. Watson, Sherlock Holmes's companion. So I haven't adapted the script. It is still in Dr. Watsonese, and I will not overdo it, but I'll use a slight Dr. Watson accent. To our right, you can see Devonshire Place, which leads in turn, going south, to Upper Wimpole Street. It was in a practice on the left-hand side of Upper Wimpole Street that my friend and literary agent, Arthur Conan Doyle, had rooms in 1891 as an eye specialist. He reported that few patients came his way, and so he turned to fiction writing, at which he became, I believe, rather successful. As we travel along this section of Marylebone Road, we are passing the very heart of the capital's private medical profession, and there immediately is its spine, Harley Street, on the right now. My own doctor's practices were elsewhere, but Sherlock Holmes's consultant, Dr. Moore Agar, worked from Harley Street. How well I remember how, back in 1897, he ordered Sherlock Holmes to take a period of complete rest to avoid a breakdown. This hardly worked, as the subsequent quiet sojourn in Devon led directly to the poisonous horrors of the adventure I called the Devil's Foot. I suppose the veneration in which Harley Street was held could be summed up in the words used to Holmes during the Valley of Fear, when the local Sussex detective involved in that case, White Mason, admitted that he regarded Sherlock Holmes as a village practitioner might regard a Harley Street specialist. We now take a diversion from the London I knew towards an iconic site for the modern day. Here is North Gower Street. Now, look immediately on the left side and you will see a red awning. That belongs to Speedy's Sandwich Bar and Cafe. And immediately next door to its left, as we slow down, is flat 187. You may know it far better as the exterior location of 221B Baker Street in the BBC television series Sherlock. You see, the amount of traffic in the real Baker Street nowadays is so great that the authorities are not inclined to allow the road to be closed for filming. So whenever you see Benedict Cumberbatch or the actor who plays me, Martin Freeman, enter or leave their house, they were actually filmed exactly here. And so now we proceed down Gower Street. And I should point out that we are entirely surrounded by buildings that are part of the University of London. And perhaps you will remember that the very first words I wrote in A Study in Scarlet ran as follows. In the year 1878, I took my degree of Doctor of Medicine of the University of London. Please look out for Montague Place, here on the left. That is where Arthur Conan Doyle rented rooms at number 23 in March 1891 on moving up to London from Southsea in Hampshire. The great building, now immediately rearing up, is the west side of the imposing British Museum. Sherlock Holmes made regular use of the facilities provided in the famous circular reading room inside the building, researching the reputation of the villain in the adventure I called The Hound of the Baskervilles, and also reading up on the history of voodooism, as it is related in the strange story of Wisteria Lodge. We now turn left into Great Russell Street and can see the imposing frontage of the British Museum, but if you are able, please look to your right and note the lovely old public house on the corner of Museum Street. If you can slow down, please, driver. It used to be called the Dog and Duck, and then changed its name after the British Museum opened in 1759 to the Museum Tavern. But I gave it a different name, to afford some protection from identification, when I wrote my, if I may say so, rather good Christmas story, The Blue Carbuncle. I called it the Alpha Inn, and it was here that Henry Baker, who worked at the museum, gathered with friends on a regular basis for several pints of ale and paid money into a goose club to obtain a bird for the festive period. He was a passing character in my tale, but this tavern remains one of the very few places I mention in London, aside from the great and famous buildings, that can easily be identified and perhaps visited by enthusiastic readers of my tales of Sherlock Holmes today. And quickly, look over to your left now, up Montague Street, for this is where, in the story called The Musgrave Ritual, I recorded that Holmes took up lodgings after finishing at university. He told me, "When I first came up to London, I had rooms in Montague Street, just round the corner from the British Museum. And there I waited, filling in my too abundant leisure time by studying all those branches of science which might make me more efficient." We're now in Holborn, and as we negotiate the road junction, please keep a lookout for the closed gates in the middle of the road to our right. Although it's now long disused, that is the entrance to the old Kingsway tram tunnel, which was built some 110 years ago, an underpass to allow London's trams to speed past this congested intersection and to join up with services from the south side of the River Thames. The old tram tracks are still down there. The great Henry V paid for this area of Holborn to be paved for the first time back in 1494, and I rather wish he had spent more on the job, to be honest. Incidentally, Charles Dickens lived for a time in a building just off to our left, and he placed his character Pip in Great Expectations in one of the structures across the road to our right. But I digress. We are now turning out of Kingsway into the eastern end of the Aldwych, and then round to the west to go along that road with that most magical name of the Strand. Leading off to our left is Fleet Street, named after the River Fleet, which ran nearby. As we continue round, look to your right and you will see the Church of St. Mary le Strand. And if you have seen a picture of the front cover of The Strand magazine, in which I, of course, published so many of my Sherlock Holmes adventures, you'll recognise its spire. And keep looking. Up there in Wellington Street, you might just snatch a glimpse of the Lyceum Theatre. It was there, by the third pillar from the left, that Sherlock Holmes, I and the beautiful Mary Morstan met someone who was to guide us towards the terrible events I chronicled as the Sign of Four, but which led, in the end, to my marriage to Mary. Now we leave the Aldwych behind and head west along the Strand. There is so much to tell you about this area. For example, here on our right is Burley Street, where Sir George Newnes published his journal Titbits and then launched the Strand magazine in January 1891. On the left, we have the entrance to one of London's oldest and most famous restaurants, now called Simpson's in the Strand, but when Holmes and I dined there, it was known as Simpson's Grand Divan Tavern. I well remember my friend suggesting something nutritious at Simpson's after his ordeal as the dying detective. And we certainly dined in the restaurant's front window during The Illustrious Client, looking down on the rushing stream of life in the Strand, I fancy I wrote. And on our right, look out for Southampton Street. If you spot the large clock overhanging the pavement upon the right-hand side, you must know that it marks the offices of the Strand magazine, where the publication had moved at the end of 1891. Now we shall shortly be approaching Charing Cross Station upon the left, and the hotel in which, at the conclusion of the adventure of the Bruce Partington plans, Holmes and that ferret-like Scotland Yard detective Inspector Lestrade arrested the spy at the heart of the tale. Immediately opposite, to the right, but now disguised by more modern developments, used to run the Lowther Shopping Arcade. How well I remember Sherlock Holmes instructing me to dash along its length to catch a hansom cab for Victoria Station and avoid the grasping hands of the minions of Professor Moriarty in the story of The Final Problem. Now, you will not need me to tell you now that we are at Trafalgar Square. We will return here later, but now we have to turn left down Northumberland Avenue, which will eventually bring us out at the Victoria Embankment by the River Thames. Three fine hotels were built along this wide thoroughfare, the Grand, the Metropole, and the Victoria. And I recall that Mr. Milas, the Greek interpreter, used to work for wealthy visitors staying in the avenue. Holmes and I, of course, famously enjoyed the healthy sweat of a Turkish bath establishment here in Northumberland Avenue. At the outset of the case, I mentioned a moment ago the illustrious client. Most importantly, I must ask that we all look to our left at the building that occupies the end of the short street called Northumberland Street. It is, of course, the public house that has, since 1957, carried the name of the Sherlock Holmes. Previously, it was called the Northumberland Arms, and was where, as the Northumberland Hotel, in my words, I placed Sir Henry Baskerville when he first arrived in London as the adventure involving, if I may say so, a rather famous hound, began to develop. Now, if you are, as I presume you are, a lover of the stories I wrote about Holmes, might I suggest that it would make a lot of sense to visit this Sherlock Holmes pub, as it contains a very good reproduction of the sitting room that he and I shared in Baker Street, together with many other pieces of original memorabilia from the famous 1951 Festival of Britain exhibition about Sherlock Holmes, just 70 years ago now. The sitting room is up just a small staircase and is well worth a look. It takes me right back to happy, if perplexing, times. If you wish, now stop and enjoy the Sherlock Holmes pub. Now, this is Dr. John H. Watson at your service as we continue our wanderings through the locations in London's West End, which featured in my stories of my great friend Sherlock Holmes. We'll continue eastwards for just a short time along the Thames embankment, and then at a safe opportunity, we shall swing us round to head west again towards the Palace of Westminster and Parliament Square. Before we turn right towards Whitehall and Parliament Square, may I draw to your attention Westminster Pier, just ahead of us on the left. I shall never forget the evening when Holmes and I joined Detective Athelney Jones on a police launch just there as we started out on our exhilarating river chase of the one-legged Jonathan Small and his terrifying companion Tonga to try and regain the great Agra treasure in the adventure I termed The Sign of Four. Now, a quick right turn up Horse Guards Avenue will take us through to Whitehall, the great thoroughfare of British government. Coming up on our left is King Charles Street, which runs along the side of the great buildings of the Foreign Office. Winston Churchill's cabinet war rooms are down there too, and well worth a visit, they tell me. That street, incidentally, played its part in my story of the Naval Treaty, as did the then Foreign Secretary, who I dubbed Lord Holdhurst. In the midst of the street, as we have passed just a moment ago, is the war memorial, the Cenotaph, raised in the years after 1918 to remember the brave warriors who died in the First World War, that war which began, as I wrote in my story of his last bow, in the most terrible August in the history of the world. Immediately now to our left, behind the police guards and high bars, runs Downing Street, where stands, of course, the official home of our Prime Minister. Sherlock Holmes and I never actually visited Number 10, but we were consulted by three Prime Ministers, and one of them, understanding the correct order of things, came to call on Holmes in Baker Street. As we near the top of Whitehall, you will start to glimpse Nelson's Column ahead of us as we return to Trafalgar Square. But before then, I should point out the narrow street called Great Scotland Yard on the right. As its name suggests, this was the home of the original Metropolitan Police Service, the world's first detective force. Think of all the detectives who consulted my friend Mr. Sherlock Holmes whenever they found themselves out of their depths. Not an uncommon occurrence. Lestrade, Gregson, Athelney Jones, Stanley Hopkins, Scotland Yard's finest, each and every one. And so we turn along the south side of Trafalgar Square, and in a moment we shall enter Pall Mall, famous for being the street of private London clubs. Through my writings, I may claim that one of them is the best known, the Diogenes Club, of which Holmes's brother Mycroft was a member, and in which no one could speak unless in the Strangers' Room. There are the Athenaeum, the Reform, the Carlton, and so on, but I doubt the Diogenes still exists. And if it did, I would not show you its doors. Mycroft Holmes, that is Sherlock Holmes's brother, lived in rooms directly opposite the club. We take a little detour now down Waterloo Place, and I want to draw to your attention a white stucco-fronted and most imposing building in Carlton House Terrace at number 10. That's it ahead of us, and to the left as we turn around the end of the road here. It is the headquarters of the British Academy, founded, as I clearly recall, in 1902, as this country's home and highest symbol of what are today is called the humanities and social sciences. Holmes and I never had need to visit the Academy, but there may be some of you who recognise its exterior. Now, I mentioned the Diogenes Club a moment ago and said I would never identify its true site, but those of you who have followed the extraordinary 21st century version of my tales on the BBC television programme Sherlock may perhaps spot the fact that its producers chose Number 10 Carlton House Terrace as the Diogenes for the two episodes they entitled The Reichenbach Fall and The Empty Hearse. Standing high above us at the end here is the statue of the grand old Duke of York, and on horseback in the middle of the carriageway is King Edward VII. I am delighted to mention, incidentally, a piece of truly esoteric information. I have never been a particular follower of those actors who took on the mantle of my friend Holmes or myself in modern media, but the Sherlock producers had a delightful casting idea as a cameo role for one of the members of the Diogenes in the Reichenbach Fall episode, the long-retired actor Douglas Wilmer, who played Mr. Holmes to great acclaim for the BBC in 1965 and who died early in 2016. At the wonderful age of 96. So, now we approach what I might have termed the very hub of empire, when, that is, we had a British empire. Piccadilly Circus, of course. And as we pass the famous statue of Eros to our right, I also want to draw to your attention one of the most important places in the whole of London. Over there, on the right, try and spot the white letters on a dark blue background which spell out the name of the Criterion. For it was when, standing late one morning at that restaurant's famous long bar, at a time when I was living alone in the metropolis and had no idea what to do with my life, that I was tapped upon the shoulder by young Stamford, who had worked under me as a dresser in St. Bartholomew's Hospital. That's Bart's, of course. We had lunch. He told me that there was a strange young man working in the chemical laboratory there who was also looking to share affordable rooms. And so it was that I was brought together later that afternoon with Mr. Sherlock Holmes. There is a plaque attached to the right-hand wall just within the Criterion, celebrating that fateful occasion, I'm embarrassed to say. Now, as we enter the southern end of Regent Street and join the great sweep of Nash's Curve, so named after its designer, the great architect John Nash, look out on your right for the entrance to the Café Royal. For it was there, in the adventure of the illustrious client, that Sherlock Holmes is badly beaten by ruffians hired by the despicable Baron Adelbert Gruner. This street was also the scene of one of the most exciting events which took place during the early stages of The Hound of the Baskervilles, when Holmes and I, while trailing Sir Henry Baskerville and Dr. James Mortimer, suddenly spotted another man in a deep black beard tracking them from a hansom cab. We gave chase but lost him until... I must not spoil the tale for those of you who, unbelievable as it may seem, have not read The Hound of the Baskervilles. Our trip up Regent Street takes us now across the junction with that most famous of West End shopping locations, Oxford Street. Directly in front of us, as we travel along Upper Regent Street, we can see the sharp spire of All Souls Church, another beautiful work of architect John Nash, and then the famous frontage of BBC Broadcasting House, looking like the prow of a majestic ship. The home of BBC Radio, it was built between 1928 and 1932, and thus did not feature in any of our true adventures. But within its studios, many, many dramatisations of my stories were recorded, especially with the actors Carlton Hobbs and Norman Shelley in the 1950s and 1960s. And then, indeed, what I like to refer to as the complete canon, all 60 of my tales from 1989 to 1998. We kink slightly to the left and then straighten into Portland Place. And here on the corner on the left stands the magisterial Langham Hotel, which opened in 1865. I made mention of it in three of my stories, A Scandal in Bohemia, The Disappearance of Lady Frances Carfax, and The Sign of Four. Mention of that last story compels me to allude to the rather complicated historical fact that Arthur Conan Doyle was taken to dine at the Langham together with Oscar Wilde on Friday, the 30th of August, 1889, by an American publisher. The result was that Wilde wrote one of his great works, The Picture of Dorian Gray, and how shall I put it? I and Doyle collaborated on The Sign of Four. Well, we are approaching the end of this bus tour now as we drive westwards along Marylebone Road towards Baker Street. On our right, we shall pass Madame Tussaud's, and then there is Baker Street Underground Station, one of the original tube stations, as I believe they are now known, constructed on the very first underground line from Paddington to Farringdon Street. The seven stop line was opened on the 10th of January, 1863. I well remember clients coming to visit Sherlock Holmes, having alighted at this station. I think specifically of the unfortunate Mr. Alexander Holder, who came to consult us over the case of the Beryl coronet, which he had rather unfortunately mislaid. I myself do not ever recall using the Underground, much preferring a hansom cab. Now, standing in front of the station entrance, you may just be able to see, above the stone parapet, the head and shoulders of a statue of my dear friend Sherlock Holmes. It was created by one of today's leading sculptors, John Doubleday, and unveiled in September 1999. The project to have it raised was organised by the Sherlock Holmes Society of London and financed, in the main part, by the Abbey National Building Society, which used to have its premises just up there to the right at this crossroad. But we are turning left into Baker Street, just for a few yards. It is not a street with great personality, compared with others we have driven along today. But, of course, it was where Sherlock Holmes and I lived, with dear Mrs. Hudson as our landlady, for many years. As I mentioned at the outset, I shall not reveal which building was, in fact, number 221B. As in the case of that Scottish loch, Loch Ness, wherein apparently resides a monster, it is often far better that specific questions remain unanswered. Baker Street is, of course, entirely unrecognisable today from as it was in the 1880s and 1890s. But I fancy many, many visitors to this great city still thrill to its name and to that of its greatest resident, Mr. Sherlock Holmes.